All right, KB1 Real Music back on track. I know you guys love this stuff and we love giving it to you. My man, Kevin Brown, aka KB1, is going to bless us with his knowledge of all things music in the 70s and 80s. And so we're just going to go on and get down. Kevin Brown, how you doing today, big dog?
My bro, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing good, man. Just kind of hanging out and loving life, living the life. That's pretty much it.
Yes, sir.
We said we wanted to talk a little bit in this segment, this podcast, about some of the great bands of the 70s. And in turn, we're going to talk a little bit about what happened to those bands as the decade came to a close.
Okay.
You and I both said we were going to talk about some of my favorite bands. So I'm going to let you go first and you can tell me who your number one band of the 70s was. And I'll chime in. I think we'll probably have some of the overlap, but we'll see. So go ahead. You start off the festivity.
Man, you put me on the hot seat right off the rip.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So if you're going to put me on the spot and make me select, because, you know, this is very difficult for me. But if I have to select my favorite band from the 70s, it would, you know, it's going to have to be the Brothers Johnson.
All right. All right. So and why? I mean, we talked about it a little bit in previous podcasts, but but give the people what they want.
Okay. That was a good one. Oh, okay. So I'd have to say, being a teenager at the time, and, you know, this is obviously during a time period where there was, you know, you didn't have music videos or channels for music videos. The only time you really got a chance to see, you know, with your own eyes, your favorite artists were, you know, when they were on the road, when they were touring, and they'd come to your town. Much different from, you know, like what had happened in the 80s with the advent of MTV and whatnot. And the reason that's significant is because, as you know, I've talked about this before, I thought I wanted to play drums. I was a pretty decent drummer at the time, you know, for my age, and was really into it. But the Brothers Johnson, I don't remember who they were touring with, but they opened up for that particular concert. And I was captivated by the showmanship and what I was hearing. I had already purchased their record. It had been out for a couple of months, but I only listened to one or two songs. I didn't really pay attention to it because, you know, this was obviously during my P-Funk era. And, you know, if it wasn't P-Funk, you know, to me, it was kind of like, you know, it was like light beer, you know, it wasn't the real deal. But when I saw what they were doing, playing live, and felt the energy, I, you know, went home and, you know, my head was spinning. Like I told you before, it's like, I want to play bass. I want to do that. I didn't even know you could do that. You know, I'd never seen, I'd already seen Bootsy. I'd already seen Larry Graham. You know, I'd already seen Verdine White, you know, all these monster bass players. But I had never seen anybody like those two cats.
So let me ask you this. I want to jump in for a second. Talk to me a little bit about the people who played around them and how good those people were. And as the supporting cast, if you will, of Brother John.
Well, okay. So, the recordings were obviously in the studio setting, and they were produced. The first four Brothers Johnson albums were produced by Quincy Jones. All right. Yeah. Actually, their first album, they had no idea they were writing and recording for them. They thought it was just more material they were doing for Quincy. And then when they finished, writing all the songs and recording them, and apparently, you know, the legend is he came in with an A&R guy and a contract and signed them. So it was like a surprise for them. Okay. But the studio musicians just reads like a who's who of who was that dude on his instrument, you know, in that particular time period. Harvey Mason on drums, Dave Grusin, who was a really great, you know, pianist. He actually was one of the founders of GRP Music, which was a big, like a jazz and fusion label in the late 70s on through in, you know, into the 90s, the late 90s, actually. Just, you know, I mean, God, I mean, Eric Gale, Richard T., Paulina DaCosta. I mean, is it, you know, if you ever were to have the time to read the liner notes, it's just like, just everybody, you know, was like somebody. It was, there were no guys that you never heard of, you know,
right.
They were on their records and they were, you know, in Quincy's wheelhouse. And so, you know, I guess if you were somebody that wanted to be taken seriously, you would definitely take that gig, you know, because there was a lot of creativity. They were hot and they were fresh and they were new. And so they, you know, working with Quincy was not a big deal. He could get the best players, you know, out there if he wanted. So,
you know, so I'm going to jump in again. You know, it's funny because it's such a small world and you never know what you're actually listening to when you're listening to it. And I'll explain it this way. So in the 80s, 86, 87, 88, I can't remember, somewhere around in there, was when Back on the Block came out.
89.
Mm-hmm. So I remember hearing the Let's Be Good to You version with Ray Charles.
And Shaka.
Thinking, and was just like, that is so hot of a cut. and I didn't know until years later when you and I were talking that Quincy produced the first one.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it was on that album, but at the time I had no idea.
Well, now that we're on the topic, just real briefly, you know, there was another song on the Back on the Block album that Quincy had produced on their first album.
Really?
Yeah, Tomorrow. That was a Brothers Johnson song.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on, because I want you to talk about some other bands, and you'll talk all day about Brothers Johnson if I let you.
Okay.
So what's the second group?
Okay, I don't like to number them, but okay, so I want to run.
I'm not saying the order. I'm just saying
Earth, Wind, and Fire has got to be there. All right,
both of us are gonna say right, that. You knew that.
Right,
Paul Collins is my favorite album of all time. So, but talk to me about Earth, Wind, and Fire. Holla at your boy.
Okay, lyrically, musically, and then. The live performances were freaking epic. When Earth, Wind, and Fire, like by the, I'd say 76, 77, when they were touring, it was like must see. You had to go see them. And, you know, again, things that you take for granted now because of the advent of the technology and the videos, it's commonplace now, but they were doing things that no one else were doing, with the exception of the P-Funk organization. The theatrics, the fire, the like magic and sorcery and, you know, the imagery and everything. On top of the actual performance, the musical performance, to me, rivaled, if it didn't exceed, the recording, the original recording of whatever they were playing. And I think you and I have talked about this before. Many of their more familiar hits, people gravitate to the live version.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not necessarily the studio, it's the live version that people actually talk about when they, you know, like you said, you know, you're a big fan of Reasons. You know, the original studio cut was that, it was fire, but the live version is just on a different level to me. And there's probably 8 or 10 songs that I would say, you know, like Devotion, that even sound right when you're listening to the studio version, you know, even the ad-lib vocal stuff that people still use it now. I've heard rap and hip-hop artists, you know, clap your hands, everybody, you know, this is like, it's always been there. It's just like a part of life, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The live version.
So I'm going to take you back to where I took you on the Brothers Johnson. Talk to me about everybody, we don't want to bore people with Maurice White and Philip Bailey stuff, and even Berdine. Who talk to me about those other guys in the band that made them the monster performance group that they were in the
Well,
70s.
in my opinion, Al McKay, the you know he was the one of the guitarists in the main edition of the Earth, Wind & Fire after the female that they had in the first on the first album. She left. They kind of reorganized a little bit, but his groove, his sense of rhythm, defined Earth, Wind & Fire for about 5 years. The cut that comes to mind probably first for me is Shining Star. Okay. It's just like, again, this is before Nile Rodgers and Chic, right? Nobody was playing stuff like he was doing on rhythm guitar. It's not a lead guitar. It's not like a real attention grabbing in your face up front tone. It's dry. It's like a part of the, it's almost like a drum or some percussion instrument that the way he's playing it. But you can't have like a Shining Star without that. You can't. That's not even the same song. It's like you don't, it's not even worth listening to, without that groove. And he wrote a lot of the songs that became, kind of anthems for them while he was with the band.
So let me ask you this. Speaking of him, is he the one playing lead guitar at the beginning of Got to Get You Into My Life?
Well, I think he and Johnny Graham, Johnny Graham did more of the lead solos and stuff. But I think that was more the way that they played that song was more like a fusion song, especially when it coming from that era.
And I know Maurice White did a lot of percussion, but who did the major drumming with them?
Well, there, I think they had another was another white brother. I'm not sure if he was actually recording on that particular.
But not on that. I'm talking about just in general
In
with them.
general, well, so they had a drummer that, and his name escapes me now, but a lot of the Earth, Wind & Fire songs were driven by, bass. It was really kind of stripped down when you talk about a groove. One of my favorites by them, it wasn't really recorded as an Earth, Wind & Fire track. It was actually recorded for the Emotions. Come on, Paul. You know I'm getting old, man.
To my boogie woman.
No, this is before then. Oh God.
That happens.
Oh
We
my
ain't
God.
as young.
Anyway, but it was before. It was a real hot track, and you and I've talked about it before. And it's basically the groove really is stripped down. It's bass, guitar, rhythm, guitar, drums, and just a little like the electric piano,
You talking about
and
Best of My Love?
not Best of My Love, but the other one about love. Golly, Paul, this is one of my favorite songs too.
Is it on that same album with Best of My Love?
I think it's the album before.
Can't think of
I'll
what you're
think
talking
of it
about. I
in a
have to look.
minute, but anyway, that's definitely one that just it just epitomized that like what I call an Earth, Wind & Fire groove from that time period.
Absolutely.
And you heard it on many songs, but like I said, Shining Star was an example. That's the Way of the World. There was a bunch of songs that just had that, to me, I call it like a signature Earth, Wind & Fire groove, and it was driven, in my opinion, by the rhythm guitar from Al McKay and the percussion, the way that they arranged the percussions and percussion instruments and all their songs.
So at their height, about how many group members were there at the time?
Well, let's see. You had two guitarists, bass, you had a drummer, you had at least one keyboard player. And I'm basing this a lot on the live
Yeah,
performances that I've
the three
seen.
horn, the horns, the
Right.
three
They
horn
had, I
guys.
think they, I'm pretty sure they have four horn players.
Okay, that's nine.
And then you had Maurice, who he played timbales and he played piano and he played the kalimba, is my favorite instrument by him that he played, as well as being a lead
Yeah.
singer and a background vocalist. You had Philip, who was also not only a lead and background vocalist, but he played the timbales well and other percussion instruments.
It's
Ralph Young,
11.
Ralph Johnson as well. I believe Ralph was also in the studio. He was one of the, you know, kind of the mainstay drummers. He played a lot of drums on some of this stuff.
That's a lot of cats.
Yeah. I would say they had about anywhere from a 16 piece band.
Good gracious.
Yeah.
And those guys all, we're going to slip into what we were talking, we're going to talk about a little bit later, but, and those guys could all make a living. I mean, I don't think anybody was getting rich, but talk about, you know, how that many people could actually make a living in a touring band.
Well, I think, you know, it was from an era where, you know, music was more of the sound and the quality of the performances was had a bigger value placed on it then than it would be in the next decade. Okay. In the next decade or toward the end of actually the 70s, the emphasis started to, just in my opinion, it started to shift towards how can we get this close to sounding good so we can cut down the personnel and keep more of this money for ourselves. And so you started to see, you know, music was changing as it always does. You know, you started to me, like a death knell for a long time, in my opinion, was the advent of people using synthesizers as bass, you know, just using a bass synthesizer.
And right.
I want to say one of my favorite bands is probably the main culprit, P-Funk. But, you know, I mean, everybody, you know, it's particularly groups that had, you know, dominant bass players. Earth, Wind & Fire, you know, like Les Groove, that's a bass synthesizer. Cameo never really got too far away from it, but they did. I mean, Brothers Johnson, a couple of their songs had bass synthesizers on, you know, some of their more popular songs. Quincy Jones started using, you know, with Michael Jackson and, you know, the PYTs and all that stuff. Bass synthesizers was like a signal to a shift, like, okay, we can use these new technological instruments, these synthesizers and drum machines, and we can start to create different sounds or more modern sounds. And, oh, by the way, we don't have to pay all these musicians. You know, now a guy that's basically a DJ and a drum machine, he can entertain folks. So instead of taking out, you know, a 15-piece band on the road where you've got to feed them and house them, you know, and protect them and transport them, now you got, you know, maybe three or four, maybe five. You know, Cameo, prime example. You know, one album, they went from like a 13, 14-piece unit down to like five.
I know.
And then down to three.
You know how big of a Cameo fan I am. And I tell people all the time and make no bones about it. Post 1980, I love them. I love them pre 1980. I mean, that was my group,
right?
You know, and I think everybody just loved Cameo. But when they went to that Alligator Woman stuff, I was like, I can take it or leave it.
But you know, it's taken me a while to get to this point, but they kind of didn't have a choice. You know, when Rick James did what he did with Super Freak, and then here comes Prince with, you know, the Dirty Mind album, and, you know, he got in, everybody was going into that rock, punk funk kind of thing. And it was like, that's the way the business was going. Like, we don't really care so much about how creative and original you are. We want you to write a song just like that, except it make it sound like y'all, but we want it to be like that. You know, so you're basically writing a song over and over and over. Because, you know, someone would come out with a hit and the record labels wanted another one of those. They didn't really want to pay some guy to be in a studio for 3 or 4 months and you know, spend all the money that they'd have to do and then hopefully recoup it. They would just say, let's do it the easy way. Write a song like that and, you know, we'll synthesize it and drum machine it to death and we'll put it out and then we'll move on to the next thing. If you don't catch on,
And people were buying it.
Exactly.
So all right. So let's move on. We talked about Earth, Wind & Fire. We talked about The Brothers Johnson. Who's the next person on your list?
Okay, so P-Funk is a person. Given. I'm just like, you know, obviously that's got to be there.
Right, and we've talked about problems before, but expand on it a little bit and talk about, like I said, we've talked about George Clinton, we've talked about Bootsy. Talk about the supporting group and how great that band was and why.
There was so much ground covered. I mean, there was so much ground covered from Jimi Hendrix influenced psychedelia, you know, with the really heavy affected rock guitar tone, to Bootsy and Maceo coming from the James Brown thing and you know, basically shifting the sound of R&B to the vocals, to the compositions, the songs that they wrote. You know, if you were a P-Funk head, you know, if you're a Funketeer, they were anthemic. You know, it was like, again, like some, like Give Up the Funk. It's like, it never stopped being played, ever. Like, yeah. You know, that was like the first radio hit. And it's not like it went away after a couple of years and you didn't hear it for 8 or 9 or 10 years. That song gets played all the time, every day. Funkadelic's like One Nation Under the Groove or Knee Deep. It's been sampled to death, and it never, those songs never went away. Flashlight never went away, never. And that was one of the first, that was another one of the bass synthesizer songs, which I love the song, but you know, I hate it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but why was their sound so rich?
Well, I mean, it was just, again, coming from the 60s, it was fresh. It was not following a trend. It was cutting a path. It was pollinating and cross-pollinating different styles, a lot of experimentation. And I guess the beauty of it, which is also the beauty of that time period for music, there wasn't the pressure of you got to go into the studio and spend as little money as possible, and you got to get a hit. Like, it was like, okay, we're Funkadelic. We already know we're not going to be played on the radio. That's not the mission. That's not the objective. The objective is we're going to record some of this shit in our head and see what it sounds like. And the top 12 or whatever, how many other songs we can fit on a record, that's who makes the cut. And then maybe the songs that don't make the cut on this record, maybe we can shift that over to Rise of Funkenstein, or maybe Bootsy can use it. You know, they had so many elements in the organization. Eddie Hazel, you know, Bootsy's Rubber Band, Parlay, you know, and just a lot of different things going on that that gave their creativity a lot of different outlets they wouldn't normally have had. But like I said, they weren't aiming for like a top 10 hit. Like, we're not trying to be, you know, we're not trying to write Thriller, you know, we're just going to record what we want to record. If you dig it, cool. If you don't, cool. We're going to do another album next year, you know? And so the creativity and just experimenting and just doing new things, that was it. That's what it was about. Like, nobody else sounded like that.
I got you. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the next group. Who's the fourth one on this list of you know, Kevin Brown's most favorite groups of the 70s?
Okay. I got to have Confunction and Slave in there. Got to.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Confunction, because that was on my list too.
Okay. Another, you know, prototypical funk band from the mid 70s. Strong horn presence.
Yep.
Funky, really funky bass and rhythm and, you know, guitar. Incredible horn section and incredible vocals. And on top of all of that, they wrote really good songs.
So, and I remember the first song I heard from Confunction, and even just knowing who that band was, I remember it was one summer. I can't remember. You were good with years. I'm not. But I remember it was one summer that Fun came out, and I lost my mind.
Yeah.
I think I was crushing on some little girl at the time, and that whole era right there, when Fun came out, that was me.
I want to say it was a 76 or 77.
Sounds
And
right.
if I'm not mistaken, that's when we were starting to hit Hayes Taylor Y parties.
There you go.
Okay. And
And
yeah,
for those
when
who
that
know,
song
it was.
came on, I mean, if you didn't feel that, man, somebody need to call 911 because
But you know, I mean, it was we've talked about this before on this pod, and people are gonna hopefully they'll be able to visualize this. But it was 15, 16, 17-year-olds in a hot, sweaty, no air condition, the Black YMCA in Greensboro, North Carolina, and it was jam-packed every Saturday night with 150, 250 kids, sweaty and just dancing, and it was, I mean, it was the time,
Well,
and it was
even more
just an
importantly
era.
than that, we were like 13 or 14, and there had to be at least 500 or 600 kids in there on some nights. And the sound system was monster.
Yeah, it was, and it had incredible acoustics in that gym. But I just remember it being dark and hot and sweaty and running around trying to get as many numbers from as many 15, 16-year-old girls as I could get my hands on. But Confunction, I mean, they did a lot of different stuff. Like I told you, they were on my list as well. And I mean, you talking about Shake and Dance, you talking about Chase Me, you talking about Let Me Put Love on Your Mind, Love Train, it was just, I mean, they did this wide swath of different types of songs, and they were incredible on all of them. Like they did some of the greatest ballads ever, and they will funk you to death.
Well, and again, we've talked about, you and I have talked about this before. That was when you couldn't just have like an album full of dance tracks. You had to have at least one ballad. You had to be able to do a ballad well, to really be taken seriously back then. And they did it really, they were probably unrivaled, them and the Commodores but like another one that I gotta put on the list, LTD. LTD was wrote some classics. They recorded some classic ballads, but again, very specific.
Concentrate on You is my jam.
I mean, they've got so many, just not just that one. But they had all the elements, the killer horn section, really, really solid bass player, guitarists, good arrangements and great songs. They wrote,
And
some
the vocals,
songs.
because of your boy.
Jeffrey Osborne
Absolutely.
was like, nobody sounded like that cat. And he was one of those voices, still is,
Yeah.
still is.
He opens his mouth and you go, "That's Jeffrey Osborne." Like he one note and you're in. He's like he's one of those iconic voices like Chaka Khan or Diana Ross or Whitney Houston. When he opens his mouth, he's unmistakably Jeffrey Osborne.
Yeah. First note you hear, just like you know who he is.
So look, you've got five out, and we're at the 30-minute mark. We're going to continue to do this, and I'm going to talk about my five on the next episode of KD1 Real Music, and we're going to get into a couple more things about how these bands ended up dismantling and going forth from there. So, are you game to do
I
that on the
mean,
next episode?
I can't wait because I want to hear your five.
All right, good, 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 good. All right, so we're going to lock it down here, and we'll see you guys next time on KB1 Real Music.
Be good, boy.